Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. So, are you loving air travel these days? The lines, the delays, the service? How do you like it? Have you been flying for many, many years, and do you notice that maybe things have changed a little bit? Joining us now to talk about how airline travel has changed and why is award-winning journalist William McGee. He's author of a new book. It's called Attention All Passengers, The Airline's Dangerous Descent, and How to Reclaim Our Skies. William is a travel journalist for Consumer Reports, an FAA-licensed aircraft dispatcher, and previously worked 7 years in airline operations management. Welcome to the show, William McGee.
Thanks very much. I appreciate you having me on.
For our listeners, the question today is, are you a frequent flyer? What irks you most about flying these days? And what safety precautions do you take when flying? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. So, William, I started it off with asking people, are you loving air travel these days? And I was wondering, what inspired you to write the book in the first place?
Well, I really was inspired to write it because so many friends and family members have come back from trips in recent years and called me up and basically just spent 15 or 20 minutes, you know, telling me about everything that went wrong. Sometimes I just sort of want to put the phone down and walk away and come back because, I hear it so frequently. But, you know, you don't need me to tell you that that air service has changed in recent years, and most polls reflect that. We've seen that customer satisfaction with the airline industry has really just plummeted over the last decade or so.
Well, shouldn't we just like it or lump it? Because on the other hand, the cost to fly doesn't seem that expensive anymore. More people can fly.
Well, I think there are two aspects to that. One is that you're absolutely right. You know, the fact is that since the airline industry was deregulated in 1978, air travel has, you know, has grown exponentially, and more people are flying than ever in the United States. There's no question about that. I would argue with the airline industry's contention that fares are lower because there are mitigating factors, and it really has to do with where you live and whether or not there's low fare competition from smaller airlines. And then, of course, there's also the fact that there are fare hikes in disguise these days through all of the fees that the airlines charge us. So, in fact, when you compare fares today with 5 or 10 years ago, when we didn't have to pay to charge, you know, to check a bag or to, you know, select a specific seat or to speak to reservations, we're really comparing apples and oranges.
But isn't that just to keep the airlines afloat? I mean, they're all going broke. They're constantly merging. There aren't as many as there used to be. There must be a financial reason for that.
Oh, no question. And one of the things I wanted to do with Attention All Passengers was sort of take a big picture look. You know, I've been sort of immersed in the airline industry now for 27 years, and I started speaking to some economists and some people outside the airline industry. And, you know, what they'll tell you is that this is an industry that has never made money over time. You can make money as a, you know, as an investor on a short-term basis in the airlines. But Warren Buffett, very famously a few years ago, said that if a capitalist had been present at Kitty Hawk, he should have shot Orville Wright down. That sort of sums up how he feels about the industry. He said he'll never invest in it again after he took a bath a few years ago. So, you know, the question of whether or not an airline or any transportation system over time, you know, can make money, it sort of remains, you know, to be seen. And, you know, there have been individual airlines like Southwest that make money. But the fact is, this is an industry that has always had financial problems, but they've accelerated in recent years. And what we've seen, you know, which is what you just pointed out, is this very dramatic consolidation. We've seen so many venerable names that have just disappeared. Pan Am, TWA, Eastern, Northwest, now Continental. And so it's a shrinking industry, and that raises concerns too, because from a consumer perspective, you know, the fewer choice usually leads to poorer service and higher fares. And from an employee perspective, this is an industry that's just been decimated in recent years. We've seen tens and tens of thousands of jobs disappear.
My guest is William McGee, travel journalist and author of Attention All Passengers, The Airline's Dangerous Descent, and How to Reclaim Our Skies. Questions or comments, we'd love to hear from frequent flyers and hear what their gripes are. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, post your question or comment there. So in your book, you talk a lot about, or you start the whole book out with talk about the simpler times of airline travel before the increase in security measures, the better days. When was that, and how was flying a different experience for you when you were growing up?
Oh, sure, no question. You know, I point out in the book that the first time I visited an airport, I was 5 years old, and I wore a suit and tie and a white shirt and, you know, shiny shoes, and I wasn't even flying. I was there to pick up my brother who was home from the service. You know, that's the way it was then. But, you know, I also say, look, let's be honest. What we wanted in 1978, when as a nation we decided to deregulate the industry, was to open it up to the free market, to not have the government, as it did previously, determine who would fly where and how much they would charge. And so that's what happened. And there's been some good and there's been some bad. But, you know, the fact is we've seen this sort of democratization of the airlines, and more people are flying than ever. That's the good news. But, you know, the concern is that a lot of things have gone wrong along the way. And I think one of the things that's most disturbing is the cost cutting and the potential that it has on the safety side.
So deregulation seems to be at the center of the change, with most deregulation pushes, say electric deregulation or something like that. They always talk about more choices and less expense for consumers, because when there's competition, you know, one of the incentives is to charge less. Flying does seem to be cheaper in some ways, like we mentioned earlier. The Airline Deregulation Act was signed into law, by the way, in 1978, October 24th, 1978. What did deregulation do, and why didn't it turn out to be better?
Well, I think, you know, no one really knew exactly what was going to happen when this genie was let out of the bottle in 1978. What struck me when I was researching the book was how many people assumed that deregulation was something that was done by President Reagan, when in fact it was President Jimmy Carter, and in Congress the number one proponent was Senator Ted Kennedy. So this was something that, you know, did not come from the right, did not come from the Republican Party. It really came from the Democratic Party. And the idea was that, you know, deregulation would open up the industry so that more people could fly and there would be more competition. And we did see that for a while. In the 1980s, there was this tremendous, you know, surge of new airlines. And then, you know, into the 1990s and into the last decade, we saw so many airlines go bankrupt and we saw so much consolidation. The fact is there are fewer airlines now and less choice in so many cities across the country than there was in 1978. So that promise of deregulation has not come true. And I think, you know, any economist will tell you, I don't think there's any argument about this, that when you have less competition, it eventually leads to poorer service and higher pricing. That's just sort of an economic truism.
I wonder if if the collective recollection that it occurred during the Reagan administration is because of the air traffic controller strike, and when he busted that union. What were the complaints by the air traffic controllers at the time in any way related to deregulation?
No question, yes, because just in the air traffic control strike took place in 1981, and in those first 3 years of deregulation, the workload on air traffic controllers just surged dramatically, because there was such an increase in new flying, new flights, and new airlines. And the air traffic controllers were responding to that, saying, you know, that they wanted work conditions and rules to try and deal with this tremendous workload. We all know how that wound up, and I write about the air traffic control strike in the book. And I think, quite frankly, even if it hadn't been aviation-related, I would have needed to write about it, because I think it was a watershed event, not just in aviation, but in American history. Because since then, we have seen union after union lose its bargaining power. And we've seen industries, you know, inside and outside of aviation that have seen their ranks just sort of decimated. And nowhere is this truer than with the airlines. I've really never written about labor issues before, but I realized when I was writing this book that I needed to address it, because you can't discuss the airline industry unless you discuss what's happened with labor. And whether it's outsourcing maintenance or outsourcing customer service or outsourcing phone calls to India, where I visited last year, this is an industry that has just, as I said, it's just been decimated from a labor perspective. And, you know, in my view, You can't discuss customer service. You can't discuss safety unless you discuss the labor issues.
At which we will certainly do later on. Rick and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Yes. I guess my biggest complaint probably with the airlines right now is leg room. You know, you can stand just about anything for a couple hours, but the last time we flew overseas, I sat down, my knees were against the seat, and within 20 minutes up in the air, a man pushed his seat back, crushed my legs, and the next 13 hours were horrible. And I'm 5'10" in my socks, and you know what a man 6'5" does on a flight like that, I have no idea. It's really gone beyond uncomfortable to inhumane. I don't think they should be allowed to do that.
It's not just our imagination, right, William McGee? They really are crushing more people into airplanes these days.
Oh, there's no question. And, you know, the caller is absolutely right. You know, and for larger passengers, taller passengers, you know, it's just a completely miserable experience these days. You know, the fact is that the airlines have they call it seat pitch, but it's just an industry term that means the distance between rows of seats. And in many cases, they've decreased that, certainly in economy class over recent years. But the other factor that, you know, that I write about at length in the book is the load factors, the percentage of seats that are occupied. We're sort of in, you know, in territory now that we've never been in before, with the brief exception of World War II when the airlines are troop carriers. For most of the history of the industry, the average load was about 60%, so 6 out of 10 seats were occupied. Now, in recent years, it's regularly been over 80%. Now, what that means is that, of course, a lot of flights are at 100%, but when you have that high a load factor, it just makes for an uncomfortable experience all around. And then when you couple that with the fact that most people are now trying to carry on bags because they're afraid to check bags with fees, it just makes for a really unpleasant experience in the cabin.
Right. Can I make one more comment?
Sure, Rick.
What about, it's just been a complete race to the bottom as far as price over the last 10 years. Why don't airlines go back to, in other words, you can't fly to San Francisco for $283. That's not a realistic price. They can't make money. Why don't they put a price of $570 on it, but you get a meal, you get a foot room, you get some of the amenities that you had before in flying?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think,
you know,
the
extra money to have the extra foot room, to get the meal, to get the, mm-hmm. you know, they're getting it back in baggage fees, so you're really not flying for $283, you're closer to $500 anyway. I think there are people who would pay the extra money to have those things back.
I think you're right. I think you're not alone by any means. I think there are a lot of passengers that feel that way because, particularly as you point out, you're paying it in fees in many cases anyway. You know, the airline industry says that you have choice. You can check a bag or not check a bag. But, of course, it's not realistic to say that you're going to go anywhere for more than 3 or 4 days, particularly if you're going overseas, if you have kids, if you're traveling with a family. You know, who among us cannot check a bag if we're going, you know, anywhere longer than a weekend? So the fact is you're paying for it. And but you're right. I mean, you use the term, you know, that I use in the book, which is this cost cutting. It's a race to the bottom. And unfortunately, we have not gotten to the bottom yet.
Rick, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Take care.
All right. Thank you.
My guest is William McGee, travel journalist and author of Attention All Passengers, The Airline's Dangerous Descent and How to Reclaim Our Skies. We'll continue our conversation with William McGee when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
This year, Columbus police have fired at 14 people. In two recent shootings, innocent bystanders were nearby. Earlier this month, a woman was wounded when an officer shot at a fleeing car in the Arena District.
In every situation that we're looking at right now and investigating, we'll compare that to case law, what the law says.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
77 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today. There is a chance of a scattered shower this afternoon, a high of 92. Partly cloudy for tonight with scattered showers and thunderstorms possible, a low of 66 degrees. Mostly sunny for Wednesday, a high of 86, and sunshine on Thursday as well, a high of 91. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is William McGee, author of Attention All Passengers, The Airline's Dangerous Descent and How to Reclaim Our Skies. William, you were talking a few minutes ago about how the transportation systems were designed just for 65 to 70% capacity. So what are all the extra seats there for, if not for passengers? What's the point?
Well, the fact is, you know, traditionally there were always some flats that were going to be fuller than others. But, you know, part of the whole science of running a transportation system is to account not just for when things go well, but when they don't go well. So traditionally, and I have personal experience in this, having been a licensed dispatcher and having worked in airline flight operations. It used to be my responsibility to deal with the situation when flights would get delayed or canceled, or you had to consolidate flights. So there was always this, you know, a time where if there was, you know, thunder showers or a snowstorm or something like that, you know, flights would be fuller and you could accommodate passengers. Now what happens is, you know, when flights are so full to begin with, when something goes wrong, it goes really wrong. And anybody who's flown in recent years knows this. It just sort of has a domino effect. And, you know, in the past, when you had, you know, maybe an hour or two of summer thunder showers, you know, it could sort of, you know, even itself out fairly quickly. Now it often just shuts down the entire system, not just in one area of the country, but throughout the country, for an entire day, for several days. And we see this time and again. And people are sort of wondering, well, what's different? And the fact is, you know, when flights are at 80 or 90 or 100%, you just can't sort of catch up and accommodate all the passengers that were, you know, that were not flown.
Jack in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Thanks an awful lot. I've been a frequent flyer for 30 years, and approximately 8-10 times a year I have to go to Paris. Okay, bottom line, from Port Columbus, you know, the merger of airlines has really given me two options and two options only if I want to get there. And I'm not going to name either airline, but the one I'm usually stuck with, let's just say the word or the name of the organization, Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, this is a classic example of everything that's been described in this program. First off, let's consider price. Go back a year ago, before this company declared bankruptcy, the ticket in low season to go round trip from Port Columbus was with taxes approximately $900. Okay, that's with check bag because it's international, etc. Okay, now that same ticket is approximately $1,350. And it's amazing. I mean, we're talking about stacked planes from Columbus. Every time I go, there is not a single seat available on the Chicago, or I should say the Columbus-Chicago flight. And furthermore, it's not run by the airline, but rather you get this illusion that it is by the name. Rather, it's run by a regional carrier that uses this eagle and these two letters, and you think that it's the regional carrier of the major airline. In point of fact, it's not. It's a company which is contracted by the national carrier. And, you know, good Lord, when things happen, you have nightmares. Let's consider last May, I don't mean this year, but the year before, I was coming back from Paris, and I just happened to do so. It was around the 20th or the 19th, and that was when a hurricane-force series of winds blew through Chicago O'Hare. Okay, everything going, you know, just stopped. They evacuated the tower. I wound up, the first time in my life, sleeping on the floor simply because all of the hotels had been already given out. There were no rental cars, yada, yada, yada. But, you know, the airline, it's interesting because I have a lot of time on these flights, too. And occasionally I'll see a member of the Chicago-based flight crew on the Paris flight that I take. And, you know, I'll chat with them. And most of these are very, very senior people, 30 to 40 years experience with the same company. And all you have to do is honestly talk with them with about 8, 9, 10 minutes. And you get from these people vitriolic hate about the way the organization has really messed around with them.
You get into that in the book as well, William McGee.
Yeah, I do, you know, because as I said earlier, I don't think it's possible to discuss the problems in the airline industry without addressing the labor issues. And you know, I'm from an airline family myself. I have a lot of family members who work in the airlines. I used to work in the airlines. I worked for Pan Am. And it's just a completely different industry, particularly over the last 10 years. And I don't think many passengers are aware of this. You know, this caller obviously, you know, has insights that I think a lot of passengers don't have. But the fact is, you know, this is an industry in which so much outsourcing has occurred that, in fact, you know, what he's referring to with the regional airlines, the major carriers call them their partners. I mean, I refer to it as outsourcing because they're really outsourcing flying itself. There have been regional airlines for many years, but they used to, you know, be used to sort of supplement what the industry calls thin routes to small cities, to rural cities. Now what we see is that in some of the busiest routes in the country, like between New York and Washington, regional airlines fly more flights than the major carriers do. In fact, 53% of all departures, airline departures in the United States every day now, are operated by regionals. It's not American or United or U.S. Airways or Delta. This is Chautauqua and Comair and Colgan and Atlantic Southeast. And, you know, as I detail in the book at great length, there are really two sets of standards in terms of comfort and convenience and even in terms of safety. And so these are issues that, you know, that we're continuing to address in this country. And I think, you know, we're just slowly starting to realize this is a bit of a bait and switch. That's how some passengers refer to it.
Jack, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. We have an email from Sam. He says, what is the difference in price between first class and economy? I have never looked into sitting in first class. It just seems like this is out of reach, an out-of-reach dream to me. But maybe it is affordable if it gets me more legroom and makes me happier?
Well, the fact is, you know, the difference can be quite considerable. It can be 3 and 4 and 5 times, you know, by that much of a factor. But there are a couple of other things that have to be addressed here. We've been talking about the consolidation in the industry. You know, every time two big airlines like U.S. Airways and America West or American and TWA or United and Continental or Delta and Northwest, when they merge, you have twice as many frequent flyers now fighting over those seats up front, either for, you know, reward travel or to get an upgrade. So we have more people than ever, you know, scrambling to sit in those seats. And, you know, the price differential is quite considerable. And then, as I just pointed out, the irony is that in many cases, regional airlines are operating, you know, more and more routes in the United States. And, in fact, you know, first class on a regional carrier is really just not worth any expense because, you know, there's no amenities. There's very few amenities in many cases. You don't have the same type of service you would have on the mainline carrier in terms of, you know, entertainment or meals or video systems or things like that, or even space. And so, you know, for me, you know, when you're traveling on business and your company is paying for you to fly in business at first, it's one thing. But I think for a growing number of passengers, it's really not an expense that most passengers, you know, are willing to commit to.
My guest is William McGee, travel journalist and author of Attention All Passengers, The Airline's Dangerous Descent and How to Reclaim Our Skies. Questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, and share your biggest gripe about flying these days. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Gary in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Yeah, hi, Ann. You know, years ago, I do mean years ago, when I was about 8 or 9, my mother and I used to fly the West Coast on occasion. We always flew Trans World, and of course, at that time, they had a long-distance aircraft called the Constellation. And of course, that was a Hughes aircraft product, and Howard Hughes had an option for the airlines that would bolt onto the bottom of the Constellation. It was like a big pod, which was later adapted for military use. But I think he knew that the passenger service was extremely expensive to operate and probably marginally profitable. We even had hot meals at that time, believe it or not. But the Constellation was an enormous aircraft for the time. Of course, it was prop-driven, and it had 3 tails across the back, which made it quite unique. With this pot on the bottom, if you carry freight, I don't know whether it was mail or small packages or what, and I don't know if Howard Hughes had an insight that maybe passenger service just wasn't that profitable at the beginning. So that may be something that, you know, in the history of the airline industry has gone by the wayside, but I guess that's just the way it is.
William McGee?
Right. I know the airplane that, you know, that you're referring to there was affectionately known as the Connie for many years. The industry has, you know, has continues to carry cargo and mail, but the fact is, you know, the biggest cost for most airlines these days is fuel, and of course that adds, you know, the added weight adds more fuel burn. But the real concern, in my view, is that, you know, it's tied to the regional issue we were just discussing. I think at a time when we need larger aircraft, that is to consolidate more flights, to have fewer planes in the air, the industry, in fact, is going in the opposite direction. And so now what we've seen is this dramatic influx in regional flying in recent years. And so we have more airplanes than ever up in the sky. So from a congestion standpoint, it's an issue. From a comfort and convenience standpoint, it's an issue. And, you know, another issue that I get into in the book is just, you know, the industry's carbon footprint. It just doesn't make sense to me that at this juncture, with the skies as crowded as they are in the United States, that we keep sending up smaller and smaller aircraft rather than larger aircraft, consolidating flights. And the idea that the airline industry says that, well, passengers want more frequent service. I think passengers would rather get there on time than have more frequent service. And if we would consolidate flights and have, you know, and have fewer flights, they'd have a much better chance of getting there on time than, you know, in many cities where there's hourly service. And in fact, you know, they're delayed all day long.
Gary, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Take care. 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call and share your concerns or not about flying. Rick from Columbus, you're bringing up an issue I wanted to bring up. So welcome to the show, Rick.
Thank you. I fly quite a bit, and I think most of these problems are with U.S. airlines. If you fly foreign airlines, I flew quite a bit in the Far East, and the food's better.
Yep.
The planes are nicer. The waitresses, the stewardesses are younger, and I'm wondering if the problem with the labor unions and the airlines is causing all this problem, or there are other factors.
William McGee.
Well, I think, you know, the fact is that airline executives right now are looking to cut costs in every way they can, and you know, I think the caller is right that there are issues that are sort of specific to the U.S. market. You know, I've flown all over the world, and I've flown on more than 100 different airlines. And, you know, you're right. There's not a perception. It's a fact that service is much better in other parts of the world, particularly in Asia. Although there is a new sort of generation of low-cost airlines in Asia and in Europe, and so we'll see what happens long-term there. But, you know, getting back to the specific cost issues, labor is a big cost for the airline industry. We mentioned fuel, but labor is a huge cost as well. And the answer for most airlines in the United States has been to downsize their workforce, to outsource. And, you know, I understand that, you know, labor, whenever you discuss labor issues and union issues, it becomes a contentious discussion for a lot of people. But the fact is, I think if you step back and look at the airline industry, there is a sort of dynamic here that says you get what you pay for. And what we've seen is an industry that, you know, had a lot of professionals in it, people with a lot of years of experience, and they were, you know, given a certain wage for those jobs. And now we've seen in many cases that work has been outsourced to the lowest bidders, and work being done in many cases by minimum wage employees or employees barely making, you know, over minimum wage, sometimes here, sometimes in developing nations. And so, you know, until we address this, I don't think we're really going to address the problems in the industry in terms of, you know, in terms of service and in terms of safety.
Rick, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. You know, getting back to the issue of outsourcing the labor for maintenance, you say it's a major safety issue because the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, has less oversight. Are they able to administer any sort of oversight when maintenance is being done in countries such as El Salvador, Mexico, and China? Because that's what we're talking about, right? And aren't they licensed mechanics there as well? Don't they have to be licensed mechanics to work on the planes anyways, wherever they are?
No, I think, you know, you might be shocked to learn that, in fact, the FAA allows unlicensed, you can't really use the term mechanics, it's technicians in some cases, unlicensed technicians to work on U.S. commercial aircraft. We've seen a dramatic increase in outsourcing of maintenance just in the last 10 years or so since September 11th. And now every airline in the United States, with the exception of American, though that's likely to change soon, now outsources most of what the industry calls the heavy maintenance on its aircraft. In some cases, it's here in the U.S., as you point out. In many cases, it's in El Salvador, China, Singapore, Mexico, and developing nations. The FAA allows non-licensed mechanics to work on airplanes. But this is a complete change in sort of the history of the industry. When I worked at Pan Am, if a job needed, you know, 10 people to work on it, all 10 of those mechanics were licensed by the FAA, and one licensed mechanic signed off on the work. Now, very often, we have a scenario whereby 10 unlicensed technicians are working on a job, but the same one mechanic from the airline signs off on it. And the FAA, I have spoken to senior FAA officials about this, and they have looked me right in the eye and say, there's no difference in those two models. I strenuously disagree because most of the experts I talk to disagree. You speak to mechanics, you speak to pilots, you speak to FAA inspectors, you know, they'll tell you there's something to be, you know, up to being certified, to being licensed. And the fact is we now, you know, have seen this dramatic change. So we have unlicensed mechanics doing the work. But the FAA says it's all the same because it's still being certified by a mechanic.
Well, some people would say, hey, there aren't more plane crashes these days. What difference does it make ultimately?
Right. Well, that's an excellent question because I think it's the fundamental question that I was addressing when I decided to write this book. And I put it to every expert I spoke to. I spoke to dozens and dozens of frontline FAA inspectors. We know that the industry has a very safe record. It always has. But the experts that I talk to on the front lines are saying that's going to change. And, you know, I know that I sound like, you know, I'm hysterical about this and the sky is falling. But the fact is, we have seen such a dramatic change in how we've always done business. The fact is, you know, the FAA has always, and its predecessor organizations, it's always had inspectors on the ground where the work is being done. So if there was a maintenance facility, there was an FAA office within a mile or two, and those inspectors could come in 24/7. Now I've been speaking to dozens and dozens of frontline FAA inspectors. They're assigned to airlines, they're assigned to overseeing the maintenance, and they can't get to the places where the work is being done. So they're not in El Salvador. They're not in China. They get there infrequently. When they do, their visit is known in advance, and they're not providing the same level of surveillance. In many ways, I've had experts tell me that, in their view, it's now become a sort of honor system. The airlines are policing themselves. They're providing electronic, you know, surveillance to the FAA, and the FAA is entering it in a database. But at the same time, I've spoken to a lot of people that have talked about problems that are not entering into the database. So when you talk about the safety record, it's not just about accidents. There's been a growing number of incidents, air turnbacks, emergency diversions, smoke in the cabin, issues like this that are maintenance-related in recent years that are not even being reported. I detail them all in the book. And on the other hand, we've also seen fatal accidents in recent years due to maintenance outsourcing. And so, you know, we need to get a handle on this because we're really in uncharted territory.
When we return, I want to talk with William McGee about the guy who monitors news reports of airline incidents and diversions of aircraft and how his numbers conflict with what the FAA is reporting. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Syria's largest city remains under siege. Tanks, helicopters, and fighter jets pound rebel-controlled areas. The government has the firepower, but many experts say the fall of President Assad is inevitable and almost universally agree.
None of this is going to end well.
I'm Neil Cohn in the Endgame in Syria. Ted Koppel joins us. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 80 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today, warming up to a high of 92. There's a chance of a scattered shower or thunderstorm this afternoon. Partly cloudy tonight with scattered rain also possible, a low of 66. Mostly sunny for Wednesday with a high of 86 degrees. And stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and it's Tech Tuesday. Social media and crowdsourcing, online newspaper paywalls, and gadgetry. Join us for Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon. And remember, you can support 89.7 NPR News at $85 and receive the WOSU member card. The member card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 300 member card partners in Central Ohio. Visit WOSU.org/membercard for more information. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is William McGee, travel journalist and author of Attention All Passengers, The Airline's Dangerous Descent, and How to Reclaim Our Skies. William McGee, let's talk about that guy that you found who was keeping track on his own and found the discrepancies between what was being reported officially and what was actually happening out there.
Sure. This is a veteran airline employee with about 40 or 50 years experience now and former airline mechanic. And he basically uses a very low-tech system. He uses Google, basically, to cull news reports that have to do with any type of emergency landings or unscheduled landings or flight diversions, and then he creates his own database. And I sat with him in his kitchen last year, and he showed me his database, and we compared it side-by-side with the FAA's public database and of what the FAA calls service difficulty reporting. And the results are staggering because basically over the last several years, he's finding that overwhelmingly most incidents that are reported in the news are not reflected in the FAA's own database.
Why is that?
Well, that's an excellent question. You know, I put it to the FAA and didn't really get a full answer to it. In 2010, for example, just of the news reports that he documented, 64% of these incidents were not filed in the FAA's own system. You know, it goes back to what we were just saying. We are really working under a new regime now, because you know, for throughout the history of the industry in the United States, we've always relied on the FAA or its predecessor organizations to provide this sort of hands-on oversight, to be able to walk into a hangar. The inspectors call it kicking the tires. In recent years, two things have happened. One is that the FAA has increasingly relied on electronic surveillance, on using, you know, automated systems to provide oversight, and at the same time, there's been this tremendous influx in outsourcing, and in many cases outside the United States, where the FAA just doesn't have, easy access. So that's why, you know, some experts are saying we're in a self-reporting system now. The airlines are reporting certain things to the FAA, but clearly not everything. And you know, this is not without documentation. I mean, I detail it in the book. And I think the most striking example for me and the most frightening example was when Northwest Airlines, which has since merged with Delta Airlines, when Northwest Airlines in 2005, its mechanics went on strike. So here you had one of the world's largest airlines, the fourth largest airline, with 369 airplanes in its fleet. And overnight, 4 out of 5 mechanics went off the job. Yet Northwest said everything is fine. And months later, when the FAA, you know, did its reporting, it filed $0 and 0 cents in fines against Northwest, even though it was later reported that FAA inspectors on the ground were finding all kinds of discrepancies and problems with Northwest. And in one case, an FAA inspector who had been discredited at the time was later vindicated. So what we see here is that there is a disconnect between exactly, you know, what's happening on the ground and what the FAA is reporting. And I think, quite frankly, it speaks to larger issues with the FAA culture. I detail an entire, there's a whole chapter in the book just addressing the FAA. And the fact is that the FAA, up until recently on its website, referred to the airlines in its mission statement, referred to the airlines as the FAA's customers. That's the type of mindset that is, in my view, so dangerous. It infuriates FAA inspectors. one inspector said to me, you know, my customers are the taxpayers, the people that fly on airplanes in the United States, not the airline. This is an organization, this is a government regulatory agency that is, you know, supposed to oversee an agency, an industry, mm-hmm. not treated as its customers.
An email from Johan. He says, I am a high school student and am a very frequent flyer. I recently got back from Europe about a week ago. One thing that I have seen recently is that the prices for flying have actually gone up from my point of view. This might be due to the fact that the airline industry is subject to the weather and no one can predict the weather 100%, which leads to delays. Also, the planes seem to be getting older and older, which leads to more and more little minor technical and hydraulic issues, which I have experienced firsthand. These cause more and more delays and overall just make the flying experience more and more unpleasant.
Yeah, well, you know, the fact is airplanes are built better than they ever have been before. So when we speak about the safety record, we're speaking about, you know, an industry that over time has gotten better. And we've worked out a lot of the gremlins and the problems that in the past, you know, plagued the industry. But in the end, they still need to be maintained. And, you know, there's this sort of adage in the industry that, well, it doesn't matter the age of the aircraft as long as it's well-maintained. But, you know, that comes with a lot of caveats. You know, it's sort of like, you know, saying, well, if you take good care of yourself, you can be, you know, you can be older and healthy. But obviously there are more concerns the older you get. And so older airplanes require more maintenance. You know, that's just the way it is, particularly for structural issues. You know, we saw last year on April Fool's Day in 2011 that the roof of a Southwest 737 peeled off in flight. Now, luckily, there were no fatalities, but that was obviously, to state the obvious, that was a very disturbing incident. And, you know, it could have easily been a complete disaster. So, you know, we're at a time where we need more focus on maintenance, not less. And unfortunately, in recent years, that's not what's been happening, you know. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is to sort of, you know, get ahead of an issue. I'm frustrated like everybody else when you read about things like what happened with, you know, regulators on Wall Street or regulators with the incident in the Gulf of Mexico a few years ago or with Toyota and, you know, failures there. And you say, well, where are the government regulators in all this? You know, I'm writing about this because it's clear that the FAA is not providing the level of oversight that a lot of experts claim that it should. And that's why, you know, I think it would be good for us for once to get ahead of an issue before it gets to the disastrous stage.
Beth in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Hi. I listened to your interview on Fresh Air. Unfortunately, I was listening to it while we were being stuck on an airline on a taxi, so it didn't make me feel so good. But what I wanted to talk about is, as you said, the outsourcing. it's gotten so bad that I just talked to a friend of mine, and his partner has now been demoted after 30 years of service in international flights, first class as a speaker. He's now been demoted to basically just doing U.S. flights, and they want to, you know, and they're cutting his pay, and they're, you know, increasing his insurance. And not only are they outsourcing the people at the ticket counter, now they're outsourcing people on the planes, the flight attendants on the planes. And the flight attendants don't get paid that much. And they really have the worst union. The baggage handlers get better union negotiations than they do. And, you know, it's just mm-hmm. for what? You know, so that then, you know, the shareholders can get more money. And then people, they're the public face. You want to know why they're so ticked off? It's because a lot of them don't even get a chance to eat because it's written into their contract the last time they had to negotiate. I mean, he's flying all over the world. Half the time he doesn't even get to eat.
Okay. Thanks, Beth.
Thanks.
Well, you know, I think Beth is absolutely correct. There's no question that, like I said, you know, it's a different industry. It's a different industry than the one that I left 20 years ago. You know, I detail in the book how I went to India and I visited the outsourced call centers there. I visited outsourced maintenance centers. I also, you know, last year went to Tulsa, Oklahoma and visited American Airlines maintenance facility. And a lot of people are wondering, is that the last major airline maintenance facility in the United States? And is it about to close soon, particularly if U.S. Airways acquires American? And that may very well happen. So I think, you know, we have to, we sort of have to step back here And I do believe that the issues that I write about in Attention All Passengers that have to do with the airlines are really bigger issues. I mean, for me, you know, as a middle-class American, I just sort of step back and say, what are we doing to the middle class in this country? I mean, do we really want to take a profession as skilled as aircraft maintenance and just hand it over and give it to China, give it to El Salvador, give it to developing nations, and put, you know, Americans out of work? You know, we have veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan who were serving, you know, overseas and were, you know, maintaining aircraft. And, you know, the contract always was, you know, you got out of the military and, you know, you get a good job in the airline industry if you had aviation experience. And now, you know, those good jobs are disappearing here. So, you know, I like Beth just said, I mean, I also question, you know, what's the big picture here? Who's getting an advantage? You know, we're in this race to reduce costs and to reduce fares. But, you know, I had a mechanic say to me last year, it's a very chilling thing. He said, you know, the next time you book a flight for $99, ask yourself where the savings come from and ask if it came from maintenance. And so, you know, we're going to have to find the bottom here. And we're also, I think, you know, going to have to address, you know, what are we doing not only to, you know, to a specific industry like the airlines, but what are we doing to the middle class?
Alan in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Alan.
I just want to sort of toot the horn of Southwest Airlines. I love to fly on Southwest. They're fun. They joke. Their attendants feel like, you know, they enjoy what they're doing. And, I mean, I've flown with my girlfriend on Halloween, and they let us put on masks and give away Halloween candy. I've flown around Christmas time, and they let us put on Santa Claus hats and give away candy canes. I
want to be on a flight with you, Alan. You sound like fun yourself.
It's fun to fly with them. And, I mean, they're cheap, too. You know, their bags fly free and all that other kind of good stuff. But it's... I have not been on a Southwest flight that I haven't enjoyed.
Any thoughts about that, William McGee? Thank you, Alan,
yeah,
by the way.
I think, you know, Alan is not unusual by any means. I think, you know, Southwest has traditionally enjoyed the best customer satisfaction ratings over time than any other airline in the United States, by far. And if you look at the Department of Transportation maintains a monthly database of consumer complaints, and dating back to the late 1980s when the database was created, Southwest has always been at the lowest among all U.S. airlines with generating consumer complaints. But I think there are two important factors. One is that Southwest, I think it's generally agreed in the industry, they do a good job of what's called managing expectation. They don't overpromise, and they deliver, you know, for the most part, what they say they'll deliver. But the other factor is they have, I think it's safe to say, they have happier employees than many other airlines. I know it's a very broad statement, and obviously there are exceptions. But many people perceive that Southwest is not unionized. It's the most heavily unionized airline in the country. Mm. But they also have sort of different work rules than at other airlines, and they get greater utilization out of their employees. But, you know, again, I think to me, all roads sort of lead back to labor in a way, because if you're going to have happier employees, I think you're going to have happier customers. And I think, you know, the inverse is certainly true as well. So my own personal feeling is that other airlines in the United States could learn quite a bit from Southwest. Southwest has been out there doing things a certain way for a while, but it's clear that a lot of the lessons haven't been learned.
Pam in Clintonville, I'll let you ask the question that I was going to ask next. Welcome to the show, Pam.
Thank you, Ann. Yes, the new speaker is delightful. I haven't been able to hear the whole hour, but what I've heard, I agree with 150%, and I do fly a lot. And I've observed a lot of these things myself, and I do also agree with his concerns about how other industries are affecting the middle class, what I would call corporatization, the effects of corporatization, as most companies seem to see it these days, and how that is affecting the middle class. But my question specifically was, and relating to your book title, well, how do we reclaim the skies? You've done an excellent job at outlining what the problems are. What can I, one person, one vote, limited resources, what can I do?
Kind of going to the subtitle of your book, William McGee, How to Reclaim Our Skies.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's the final section of the book. I basically put forth a manifesto of what I would suggest based on lengthy discussions with people in the industry and the true experts, the people that are out there working in the industry every day. You know, how can we change things? You know, I had someone say to me recently, boy, you must be very cynical because, you know, you outline all these problems. I remain optimistic. You know, the fact is, I think these are problems that were created by people and they can be solved by people. You know, when you look at, you know, outsourcing, for example, that's something that can be reversed, I believe. I don't think it's too late. It may be too late if we wait a few more years. So I put forth a very detailed manifesto. But, you know, in direct response to what Sam said, you know, the fact is these are big picture issues, and these are issues that, you know, we as individuals are limited in addressing. I think, you know, I have a whole chapter detailing the airline industry's influence on Washington. I try to be as fair and balanced about it as possible. I think the fact is there's enough documentation to show that both major parties, you know, have accepted an awful lot of money from this industry, and that applies not just in Congress but to the White House as well. And, you know, what that means is that we're going to have to, you know, rethink, you know, how we regulate this industry. And I understand these are big problems, and they're going to require, you know, big solutions. But what I detail is what I think the Federal Aviation Administration can do, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Homeland Security, mm-hmm. Congress, the White House. And I do, just to sort of cut to the chase, I do recommend partial re-regulation, not to the extent that we had before where the government decided, you know, how much a fare would be from Columbus to Chicago. But we need more oversight, particularly on the safety issues, because we have an industry that in many ways is sort of policing itself.
William McGee, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it as well.
William McGee, author of Attention All Passengers, The Airline's Dangerous Descent and How to Reclaim Our Skies. By the way, you can listen back to today's shows and every show by visiting WOSU.org/allsides. Go to our archive. You can find more information, links, audio, video, and podcasts. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.